Welcome, everybody, to Redacted on this Tuesday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And on this show, we try to connect the dots, navigating this crazy clown world together and covering the stories the mainstream media is largely ignoring. And tonight, we're going to be looking at Julian Assange from multiple angles because day one of the Julian Assange extradition hearing has just wrapped up. The defense has rested their initial testimony today, their initial arguments. Did they make a compelling case? We're going to go to the courthouse in London for an update on that. We're also going to be joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald. It's going to be joining us here for his analysis on Julian Assange and where things go from here.
We're also going to talk about European leaders who continue to fail up even as they fail European citizens. We're talking about Mark Rutte, who failed as the Prime Minister of the Netherlands but is going to run NATO. We're talking about Ursula von der Leyen, who wants a second term. We're going to be joined by Rolf Schollheimer to talk about that. Isn't that nice? You lose every election, and then you get to just more power.
You get more power. That's how it works in Washington as well. We're also going to be looking at attacks on civilians this afternoon. We saw multiple civilian attacks in Donetsk. Of course, this is Russian territory now. This is Russia. And these are HIMARS attacks on civilians at a library. We're going to bring you a report from there. And
this fluoride trial, we really want to draw your attention to that because that has been going on for years. It's wrapping up in San Francisco today. It is an acknowledgement from the U.S. government that this hurts people. We're going to take a look at the actual data. It will blow your mind and make you want to save for a reverse osmosis system. I'm going to tell you that right now.
All right. So all of that and more as Redacted starts right now. All right, let us know where you're joining us from around the world. We are live. It is 4 p.m. Eastern time. It's just after 9 p.m. London time, which we are going to go to the courthouse in London to talk with journalist Taylor Hudak, who was in the courtroom all day today to get her update on what exactly happened on the part of Julian Assange's defense team. Will he be sent to the United States, where he would basically be put away for the rest of his life, 145 years in a supermax prison? This is one of the most important days in journalism history today, so we're going to get an update on that in just a second.
There's electricity in the air, I tell you. A lot to get to. But first, we want to remind you that Redacted is brought to you by Nom Nom because they are our show sponsor today. Of course, your pet is a member of the family, so don't feed them like they're in the dog house. Give them Nom Nom. Nom Nom delivers freshly made dog food with every portion personalized to your dog's needs so you can bring out their very best. Nom Nom has already delivered over 40 million meals to good dogs like yours, inspiring millions of clean bowls and tail wags. So try it out. Go to Nom Nom, tell them what your doggy is like, and see what they can do to optimize their health. You can get a doggy smile just like that. Right now, you can get 50% off your no-risk two-week trial by going to trynom.com/redacted. No fillers, no nonsense, just Nom Nom. Once again, that's trynom.com/redacted. That's trynom.com/redacted for 50% off.
Well, the defense has rested today in the first day of Julian Assange's extradition hearing. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden said this is the most important press freedom case in the world. It's being decided this week. I don't think anyone could argue against that. So day one of the hearing just wrapped up in London, and journalist Taylor Hudak was inside the courthouse all day today, trying to listen in to what the defense was presenting here, making their case that Assange should not be sent to the United States, should not be extradited to the United States. And Taylor joins us now just outside of the courthouse, just walking out there after the defense has rested. Taylor, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the show. You sort of set the stage. I mean, what was it like outside the courthouse and inside the courthouse before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you saw today?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for having me to speak about this very important press freedom and human rights case. That is, of course, the prosecution and extradition proceedings of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. I'm outside the courthouse. This is the Royal Courts of Justice behind me, where we just wrapped up the first day of this two-day appeal hearing. And this is, or very well could be, Julian Assange's last attempt to appeal before the domestic UK courts. Now, when I first arrived here at about 9:15 this morning, I was blown away by how many supporters and protesters were here standing up for Julian Assange. They were standing up for press freedom, gathered outside here. And then in the courtroom, it was a packed courthouse. They actually had a spillover room for those who were not able to make it into the main courtroom. I was fortunate enough to be placed in the main courtroom. And I have to say that the defense has an unbelievably strong argument. Now, what they are arguing for is for this panel of two high court judges to allow them to appeal this case once again domestically in the UK. So the outcome of this case is that either Assange will have that opportunity to appeal once again and potentially prevent his extradition to the United States, or what could happen is that he would enter into the extradition process, which for those who care about free speech, that is certainly not something that we would want to happen, and those who also care about the free press. So it was a really strong and positive day in court, and both of the attorneys who are representing Assange made excellent points in court today.
So people can follow along with your court coverage, by the way, I should point out, on your Telegram channel. Can you share that with our audience so if people want to follow you while you're inside the courtroom over the next few days, first of all?
Yes, of course. I've been doing my best to update my Telegram channel. It's Taylor Hudak News at Taylor Hudak. I'm also active on Twitter, but I didn't go the live tweeting route this time. I decided to post updates there. Again, that's at Taylor Hudak, Taylor Hudak Media on Telegram. And I try to keep everybody as up to date as possible. A few key points from today that will be of interest to the listeners, many Americans as well, is the fact that once on U.S. soil, if Assange is extradited, let's hope he's not. It's still unclear at this point. He may not be extradited. But if he is, he is not going to be granted First Amendment protections because he is not American. He's an Australian citizen. So despite the fact that he is charged by the U.S. government, despite the fact that he would be tried on U.S. soil, he is not afforded those protections. However, he is still subjected to the Espionage Act. And in fact, the defense argued that once on U.S. soil, they could bring forth additional charges, which could possibly include treason, which would also make him potentially eligible for the death penalty. And anyone who's familiar with extradition law knows, especially in the extradition treaties with European governments and the U.S. government, oftentimes, almost always, I want to say, that extradition is barred if the death penalty is a possibility. So that's also a very strong point in this case. And also the fact that he cannot be extradited to the United States for political purposes, and that is under the U.S.-UK Extradition Treaty, Article 4.
Right. I mean, that's a great point. Of course, the being extradited for political purposes. How could anyone read this anything other than politically motivated prosecution of Julian Assange?
Exactly.
I don't know. I think you'd have to be a mental patient, operating at that level. So when you were sitting there listening to the defense today, what were some of your key takeaways? And you said earlier that you thought they laid out a really strong case today. What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was the extensive amount of case law that supports their own legal case that they're fighting right now, the legal precedent that has already been set. Additionally, what was a very important point is that this would be an unprecedented case. This would be the first time that a journalist would be tried under the U.S. Espionage Act for the receipt, for obtaining and publishing classified material. This is something that journalists do all the time, and they're seeking to criminalize that. And there has been cases. There was one that was mentioned back in 2006 where they were potentially going to punish a journalist, or charge him rather, under the Espionage Act for publishing. They chose not to do that in the United States, and therefore the case never went forward. So that was strong in Assange's favor.
And so do you think that the judge was moved by these arguments?
That's a really good point. So I did, be sure to pay attention to the judges here. And I noticed that one of the judges was shaking her head a few times. They did ask several questions, which I think is normal, and which they are you know, able to do, of course. I think that's sort of part of the UK procedure. But there's also another thing that I want to address for the listeners. They're going to find this point interesting, because this was not something I myself was all too familiar with, despite covering this case for quite a while now, was the fact that the defense lawyer was asking what triggered this prosecution at this specific time. Remember, Assange is being charged for publications that were released back in around 2010. The charges did not come out until around 2016, 2017. And so he was asking what triggered this, and what does that say about the state's motivations, the state being the U.S. government? And in fact, the International Criminal Court, or ICC, announced that it was going to launch an investigation due to these publications that were released by WikiLeaks shortly after this announcement and its intention to investigate. That is the ICC's intention to investigate. The United States public officials began to refer to Julian Assange very publicly as a political actor. And then famously in 2017, then director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, referred to Julian Assange as a non-state hostile intelligence agency, or WikiLeaks rather, as a non-state hostile intelligence agency, which is actually very significant because that holds some legal weight, in fact, using that exact phrase. But it is interesting to note that the ICC would have to rely on Julian Assange as part of their investigation, and it was at the same time, shortly thereafter, that these charges were then brought forth against Mr. Assange. So that's just another interesting piece of evidence. Yes, it is circumstantial evidence, but I think it's important for people to be aware of, and then they can make up their own minds of what that means and what that timing, what it signifies.
So that, of course, is the legal side of all of this. What about the health and well-being of Julian Assange? Did this come up in any of the discussions today? Never being able to live and be in the same house as his children, for crying out loud, and the conditions being, I mean, we've talked about this on our show, but of course you've had other people awaiting extradition. They've been put up in cushy environments right outside of Buckingham Palace in beautiful, you know, a beautiful arrangement. And here you have Julian Assange wallowing away, wasting away basically in Belmarsh prison. So did this come up today?
Exactly. He's been in prison, in Belmarsh prison, for almost 5 years now. Now, at the start of the hearing, it was mentioned by the judge straight away that Mr. Assange did request for permission to attend in person. He was granted that permission, but he did not attend because of his health. The judge did not disclose any further, and beyond that, his health was not addressed in the court. But it's important for people to remember that the lower court judge, the district judge, Vanessa Breitzer, initially denied the extradition request on grounds that it would be oppressive to extradite Assange to the United States due to his health condition and his mental condition. She felt that it would be oppressive, citing Section 91 of the UK Extradition Act. So, important to remember, this case was initially, or this extradition order was initially rejected for health reasons. And while we do talk a lot about the legal points, technical aspects of the case, this is a human being. He's a father, a son, a brother, a friend to many people, and he's suffering tremendously. That's what is stated by his family members. He's suffering. They are also suffering that they can't be with him.
It's just absolutely awful. I know it's freezing there. You've been so kind and gracious with your time after this hearing today. I'll let you go on this, which is, what do you expect tomorrow for the second day?
Yes. So earlier that the defense has rested its case today. There's one day left tomorrow, and we expect the prosecution to rebut the arguments that were presented today. Now they have the chance to present their arguments, and then it's still unclear whether or not the judges will issue a decision tomorrow or if it will take a few weeks. Historically, with this case, it has taken a few weeks. I do think that is pretty standard, but I will be doing my best to keep everyone posted in real time on my Telegram channel, again, at Taylor Hudak, Taylor Hudak Media, and then also on my Twitter, which is @_TaylorHudak. I would encourage everybody listening, please talk to your friends, your family members, your neighbors about this case. Raise awareness. If you're in the United States, contact the White House in a polite and respectful way. Share your concerns about this case also with your local representatives, and do act now to make a difference, because everybody's right to know and access information is at stake.
100%. 100%. Taylor Hudak, live for us tonight outside of the courthouse covering the first day of the Julian Assange hearing. We appreciate it very, very much, and we'll be following along with you as your coverage unfolds. Thank you so much, Taylor. And please.
Thank you for having me.
Go get warm. Thank you.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Taylor. We appreciate it. And I should also mention, in addition to her Telegram channel, she's also posting updates on Activism Munich on YouTube as well. So she can check that out. So thanks to Taylor for that. Well, there is perhaps no better journalist in the world to help us make sense of the importance of the Julian Assange case and what that is to the future of press freedom than Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald and host of System Update right here on Rumble, streaming live on Rumble, just as we do here. And we want to welcome Glenn to the show tonight to talk all about this. Glenn, welcome to Redacted. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Always happy to be on fellow Rumble programs. It's good to be with you.
Great to have you, Glenn, as always. It's great to get your insights on topics like this. The defense, of course, made a number of compelling arguments today against extradition to the United States. Two points, though, really stood out to me, and I want to get your take on this. Now, according to Taylor, who you just heard there, who was just on our show, defense lawyer Mark Summers argued that there's no evidence that anyone has been harmed as a result of WikiLeaks publications. That's point one. And I just had to sit there and sit back for a second after I heard that argument and say, wait a second, that's true. Like at the heart of this, who really has been hurt by the WikiLeaks publications? I mean, if you think about the size and scope of the military-industrial complex, it's grown by leaps and bounds. The intelligence community, the intelligence state has grown by leaps and bounds. So maybe they've even flourished under this. What do you think about that? At least that one part of the argument from the defense.
This is a completely standard tactic, propagandistically speaking, on the part of the U.S. security state going back decades. Every single time there's a leak of information that they want to hide, not to protect the security, the national security of the United States, but to protect their own reputation, because these leaks reveal lies and deceit and crimes that they've committed. That was true of the Pentagon Papers. It was true of our reporting in the Edward Snowden archives. It's been true of all of the WikiLeaks reporting. And what they have convinced people of to believe, almost like reflexively without having to present any evidence, is that every time there's a leak of classified information, it necessarily means that people in the field have been put into danger, that the names of undercover operatives have been revealed to our enemies, that it has endangered all sorts of people all over the world. Every single time you ask someone who makes that claim about any of these leaks to give you a single example of a single name of an operative or an undercover agent or an informant that has been disclosed by these materials, they will be completely incapable of providing it to you. Right when the WikiLeaks leak happened in 2010, the government constantly came out and made claims. It was the Obama administration saying WikiLeaks and Julian Assange have blood on their hands. And when reporters finally started asking, well, what blood do they have on their hands? They started realizing that they had been misled, that there was nobody who had been harmed, exactly as your question suggested. And then good reporters, like the ones who worked at McClatchy, one of the very few to question the Iraqi WMD lie, started publishing articles that you can find online, which essentially said that the U.S. government completely exaggerated, if not fabricated, all of these wild claims. And even U.S. generals came out and said the idea that these materials have harmed Americans or put people in danger is probably a fabrication. But it's one of the things that they have instilled in our bloodstream to get people to almost automatically oppose anybody who exposes things that they have decided should be secret.
One of the other questions, and that's such a great point, and one of the other questions that came up was the idea about the political prosecution. And of course, under the extradition treaty, this is a violation of the extradition treaty, right? You can't be extradited for political purposes. I mean, that's literally written right in the statute. So how is the prosecution tomorrow, you think, going to make the case that, yeah, we just need to violate this extradition treaty and we need to send them to the United States?
I mean, we can go over the legal arguments if you want. I'm happy to do so. The legal arguments are extremely compelling, but there's a broader political reality here, namely that these arguments have been made, these same arguments, and every step along the way. This is the final appeal that Julian has within the British judiciary, and every single level of the British courts have rejected every single argument, the one exception being that the very first judge to look at this ruled against him on all instances, except said that he was unlikely to survive an extradition to the United States and therefore ruled against the extradition request. That was reversed on appeal when the U.S. government made a bunch of assurances about protecting his health, none of which are reliable since they're all conditional. So we can definitely analyze the validity of the legal arguments, and they're extremely potent in favor of Assange. The problem is that the U.K. is basically a puppet country of the United States. They do what the United States government tells them to do. They're a tiny little former empire who has no prestige and no power in the world. They're constantly kind of trailing along with whatever the United States government tells them to do. Their judiciary has very little independence left. The British judiciary once was renowned for its independence, and now it has very little left. And I wish more than anything that I was more optimistic about the outcome of this case. I hope more than anything that I'm wrong. But just for political reasons, the fact that there's so much hysteria about Russia, that they have convinced the West that Assange is an agent of the Russian government, even though that has no basis, the chances that any court in the UK will intervene and tell the United States that they will not get this extradition, unless behind the scenes the Biden administration doesn't really want to bring him to American soil to stand trial, which I actually think is possible for reasons we can discuss if you want. The notion that the British judges on their own will protect Julian Assange, no matter how compelling the legal arguments, seems very, very remote to me.
I want to ask a question because I think that brings up a good point about Assange as a chess piece and how he could be useful to, say, Rishi Sunak or the Biden administration so that they can hold him up as a just position for, Alexei Navalny, right? He wasn't let out, even though we know he was not a journalist. And so what are the implications? What are the possible ways that he could be used? You bring up a good point. Let's play that out a little, if you don't mind.
So by all accounts, if you listen to Assange's doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists and family members, he's already basically destroyed as a person, physically, psychologically, emotionally. I visited him back in 2017 when he was still at the Ecuadorian embassy, just a few months before he was taken out by the London police and brought to prison. And I was shocked by what I saw when I visited him. I mean, he was still mentally acute, but, you know, he had been inside of an embassy, like a one-bedroom apartment, basically in the middle of London with no outdoor space for many years by that point, which completely corrodes your physical health. Now he's in a high-security prison. This is not a joke of a prison. The BBC has called this the British Guantanamo. This is where terrorist suspects go and organized criminal suspects. This is a high-security prison. He's been there now for 4 or 5 years. This is hard jail time he's done. And so I think that the goal of the U.S. government was just to destroy Julian Assange. And on some level, they've already achieved that in a way that will serve their interests, I think, even more so than letting him out. Imagine if they do actually succeed in this extradition, and then Julian Assange comes and stands trial in a Northern Virginia courthouse as the first ever publisher of information to be charged with espionage crimes and face life in prison for having published documents that he did not help acquire, setting a standard that every press freedom and civil liberties group in the West has said is a grave threat to press freedom. I don't think that the Biden administration wants that on their legacy, nor do I think they want this incredible sideshow, this drama that's going to happen outside that courthouse with protesters, with Julian Assange taking the stand, saying who knows what, with his ability to demand classified information that they won't want to give him. One of the things that has changed in this case politically is that the Australian government, pressured by the Australian citizenry, remember, Julian Assange is a citizen of Australia, that's the only country of which he's ever been a citizen, right, has finally started telling Australia, why aren't you protecting our citizen? And the prime minister has now come out publicly and privately and told the United States, enough is enough, it's time to release him. And that diplomatic solution is one exit that everybody has to both get Assange totally neutralized and destroyed out of this court system, feeling like they've neutralized him in WikiLeaks and no longer need to worry about him, but at the same time don't need to bring him to the United States in order to create this Navalny comparison.
Do you think that does the Australian government have that power to be able to bring him to Australia, do you think?
Australia is a very important junior ally of the United States, especially with this kind of shift to the focus on Asia and the Pacific and China. The United States has just closed this very important new alliance with the UK and with Australia, where nuclear submarines are going to be placed in Australia as a deterrent against China. So the importance of Australia has actually increased pretty significantly in the last few years, but it's still a subservient relationship, just like with the UK and the US. But if the Australians really wanted badly enough to get their citizen back, I think they could do it. The problem is that there are a lot of factions inside Washington that consider Julian Assange and Edward Snowden to be the devil. There is nobody they want to destroy more. And I think one of the things they fear in Langley and in the other three-letter agencies is that Assange gets free, isn't quite as physically or psychologically distinct, and then gets to live life freely as a hero who stood up to the U.S. security and kind of becomes a symbol that might inspire others to do the same thing. I think that's the thing they fear most. So Australia might have a lot of leverage, but the CIA and the Pentagon and the documents from which these agencies came, that the State Department that Assange published, also have a lot of leverage, and it all depends on how badly they want him fully destroyed.
Can I ask you sort of an esoteric question, really, but I guess it's how much damage has already been done to journalism as a result of this, regardless of the outcome of what happens next?
So I'll just tell you a little anecdote that involved myself, which was in May of 2019, I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post when this indictment was released, warning that the theories on which this indictment were based would be a threat to all investigative journalism everywhere, that it was essentially a theory that would enable states throughout the West to criminalize investigative journalism of all kind, because the argument that they made about why Assange did something the Guardian and the New York Times didn't do, namely receive, they didn't heed this information, they say, he became a conspirator with his source, Chelsea Manning, by doing things like encouraging her to get more documents or helping her evade detection. That is something that investigative journalists do all the time. And my argument in the Washington Post op-ed was, if that becomes criminal, every investigative journalist is going to be easily criminalized. And unbeknownst to me at the time, about 2 weeks later, I had a major source in Brazil hand me a huge archive of secret material that I ended up reporting on that changed the course of Brazil. It basically freed Lula da Silva from prison. It changed the course of Brazilian political history in so many ways. And I ended up indicted by allies of the justice minister in Brazil based on exactly this theory that by encouraging my source to get more information, by helping them avoid detection, even though I wasn't part of the acquisition of the documents, I had become a conspirator in the crimes committed by my source based on exactly the blueprint used to prosecute Julian Assange. And I ended up being exonerated because the Brazilian court intervened and said my press freedoms guaranteed by the Brazilian constitution prohibit my prosecution. But I was lucky. I mean, I could have easily been in Julian Assange's position. And so can every investigative journalist if this indictment ends up being upheld. But as you said, the mere fact that the U.S. government has already stood behind it is a signal to other governments that, well, if the United States can do this to journalists, then certainly we can too.
Right. And so you're an expat living abroad. We are too. And so you have to wonder, where is it safe to do journalism? Do I need to look into the country that I'm living in and their relationship with the United States as the world's central bully? That's something that we think about all the time. But I have to wonder, because most of his alleged crimes happened almost a decade ago or over that much time. And now when the government sees something they don't like, they can censor. They can label it misinformation, or they defame the person, and that's been fairly successful. So do they have what they need in the cautionary tale of Assange because they're otherwise they've got these other nefarious tools now? I mean, that doesn't make me feel any better, right? But it's a little bit less personal now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, one of the amazing things about this case is that not only is Julian Assange not a citizen of the United States, I can't tell you how often I hear people accusing him of treason.
Right.
Do Americans think that every citizen in the world of every other country, namely 95% of the planet who are not Americans, have some overarching duty of loyalty to the United States government? But he's only been to the United States one time for about 3 days. And so the fact that the government, the U.S. government, asserts the power to reach across the world and grab him and take him back to the United States for the reporting, of course, if you're a U.S. citizen living abroad or anywhere, you're going to be pretty alarmed by that. I think at least you should be. And I think the point that you asked is the most important one. You know, when I was advocating for Edward Snowden's pardon in the last days of the Trump administration, and Trump got pretty close, but really felt like there was a lot of opposition arrayed against him. And I think that final impeachment was a sort of Damocles sword hanging over his head to make sure he didn't do things on the way out, like declassify JFK files and pardon Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. It was kind of odd to me how important it was to the U.S. security state that Edward Snowden not be pardoned and allowed to come home. After all, he's no threat to anybody, has no more access to classified material. And yet what they're so interested in is the deterrent effect, that everyone has to know that if you defy or report on the U.S. security state in a way that they dislike, they want you to know that you will end up being destroyed. And they can't allow somebody like Edward Snowden, like Julian Assange, to be able to go free, have a hero's welcome. That's the reason why they pursue these cases long past the point where the person continued to pose a threat to them.
I'll get you out of here on this, Glenn, which is, where do you think this goes from here? Do you think he is extradited back to the United States?
Well, I think one of the scary parts here is that if this court rejects the arguments of his lawyers and approves the extradition request, as the lower courts have done, he might be subject to immediate deportation. He wants to appeal to a European court and argue that the UK, though not part of the EU after Brexit, is still subject to European law and human rights. And they may not want him to do that. They might want to extradite him immediately. And so the minute that this decision is issued, before he has a chance to appeal, they could put him on a plane to Washington, and he will be on U.S. soil. Now, again, I don't trust the U.K. judiciary. I think the only hope is that there's some diplomatic solution that we're not privy to that in some way results in his release. But it could very well be the case that, you know, he's a matter of a couple of weeks away from getting on a plane and coming to American soil, where I'm convinced he will never leave.
Unbelievable. Goodness. Well, I was right. There's perhaps no one better in the world to talk about this from a journalistic perspective than Glenn Greenwald.
Sorry, I didn't have better news for you, and I left it with kind of a gloomy impression, but that's the one.
Well, no, so my brain is thinking in terms of something you said earlier, which is, you know, maybe the Biden administration doesn't want to deal with this in this way, right? They don't want this to be their legacy, and perhaps maybe that is the silver lining. So in my brain, I always go to the glass half full. So I'm thinking of the silver lining here, that the Biden administration has a whole other heaping ton of problems right now on their plate. They do not want to have tens of thousands of people descending on Washington, D.C., because I would take my show there. We would broadcast live from that event, and we would make it as loud as possible if that happened in the United States. So I don't think they want that headache. So that's the silver lining that I see, Glenn.
I couldn't agree with you more. And remember, every media outlet, from the New York Times to the Guardian to the Washington Post, has editorialized against this prosecution. They won't have many allies in this prosecution if they go forward with it. So I think it's a huge headache for them when they already have so many others, as you suggested, 7 months away from an election. And that is the one hope that I think Assange and his supporters have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm hoping for a miracle too. Thank you for coming on Redacted for the first time. We're longtime watchers of your show, and we really are so excited to have had you on.
You got to watch System Update on Rumble. Absolutely. System Update on Rumble.
Guys,
thank you so much, Glenn, and don't be a stranger. Hopefully we'll have you back soon.
Happy to do it. Good night.
All right, thanks, Glenn. Unbelievable. I think he's obviously spot on so many points there. It's troubling to think about the future of journalism, and in both, you know, as Americans, wherever you're living around the world, we see the trouble obviously in Europe right now with journalists who are worried about the European Union and where they have to go. And so
right.
Journalists who are in Germany and the Netherlands and other places, they're saying we're getting out of here because we don't feel safe here from a journalistic perspective. What we're covering could lead us to a criminal prosecution under the government, under the EU, and under German law. It's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying.
It sure is. So we're going to continue to cover this story as it unfolds and see what's what. Thank you so much for your interest, and thank you for sharing your concerns about Julian Assange loud and clear on whatever platform you feel like you have to share that. So we have more news to get to. We're going to talk about European leaders, why they're the worst. That's the tease.
Right.
That's the story.
The news at 11. Ursula von der Leyen is seeking another term. And I mean, the EU and the energy crisis, you have Germany just entering a recession, and you have countries across Europe now facing the same fate. I mean, they are driving the European Union into the ground, and Europe is facing collapse. And these globalists are doing it, you know, smirkingly and very happily, and they want to get more power. So we're going to look more closely at that. But first, let me pull up my stuff here because I don't have it.
After that, I want you to please stick around for the story that we're going to do about the fluoride trial, because this is something that's been going on for years and getting virtually no media attention. Now, the government has admitted that they know that there is a terrible connection between human health and fluoride. Also, Rachel Levine has been redacting some of that information. There's also connection to the World Health Organization, so you're not going to want to miss that story as well. But first.
You know, if you ever Google your name, you ever Google your information, just do that sometime, and you're going to be stunned at what personal information comes up about you and your family, and it's unbelievable. Data brokers are selling your information to scammers, spammers, and anyone else who may want to target you. Your full name, your email, your home address, your health records, your relatives' information, it's all out there. So our sponsor at Aura is going to help you clean all of that up. And you can start your two-week free trial right now by going to aura.com/redacted. And it's amazing. Within those free 2 weeks, you're going to be stunned at what information they can help get rid of offline, because these data brokers sell all of this stuff. And it's remarkable. They do so much more to protect you and your family from online threats that you can't even see. So when you sign up for Aura, it's not just a VPN, and then they're not just cleaning up back information. They're actually physically going out there and making sure that all of these other data brokers are removing your information. They have to do it by law, or they will be prosecuted. You may already have one of these tools floating around. You may have a VPN. You may have some other stuff helping you out a little bit, but no one does it like Aura. It's always on. They do all of these things under one roof, doing all of the hard work of keeping you safe so you can focus on other tasks with peace of mind. So if you want to try them today, start your two-week free trial right now. Go to aura.com/redacted. That's aura.com/redacted.
Europe is hell-bent to collapse under its current rulers, and those same rulers are getting promotions, it would seem. EU President Ursula von der Leyen announced that she will run for a second term, which would give her another 5 years in office. You can tell the way I say that, how I feel about it. I cannot be neutral. Mark Rutte, former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, is about to be tapped to run NATO after resigning in failure. So have we learned nothing? Ralf Schollheimer joins us. He predicted this. If we rewind the tape, when Rutte resigned, you were right here on Redacted and said, I think he will run NATO. Would you like to take a victory lap on that and say, I told you so?
Well, let's put it this way. It's a victory for me, but not necessarily a victory for the broader world. Right. You can argue, if you're incapable of running the Netherlands, are you sure you're capable of running the world's largest military alliance? But this is how things work in those bubbles. You can only fail upwards. I looked it up before the show. If you look at somebody like Ursula von der Leyen, whenever she stood for election in Germany, she lost every single one. Like, she has not ever held an office that was truly democratically legitimized. But once you are in these circles, once you have a certain position, you can never get them out. Like, you cannot vote those people out. It's really like in a horror movie, you know, where you see the monster die at the end, but then there is this one last camera shot where the hand comes out of the swamp, or where the hand comes out of the grave. That's how it is with these people, like with Mark Rutte, right? I'm gone, and yet here is back again. And von der Leyen, the same thing. Like, she's unpopular. Nobody likes her. Nobody wants her, but she's just not going away. It's very, very frustrating.
Now, as an American, we at least like to think we have a direct route to our representative leaders. You live in a place, you vote for those leaders. But in the European Union, it's the elected leaders in each individual state that then votes into the European Commission. So European citizens have almost nothing to say about it. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, in a sense, the European Union lives up to what it was always designed to be, which is a kind of a straitjacket on the will of the population. We should not forget, and by the way, this is not something I agree with, but I think we have to be historically honest. The design of the European Union, or the project, was always to be a safeguard against the supposed darker instincts of the European population. It was a 1970s solution to a 1940s problem. So the idea was, if you forcefully, by bureaucratic force mostly, unify the Europeans, something like nationalism, fascism, authoritarianism can never emerge again. The problem now is, however, that the cure has become the disease. So in many ways, the European Union becomes more and more authoritarian in themselves. We see this in the treatment of Hungary. We see this in the restrictions and the regulations when it comes to information and social media, at least what they're attempting to do. They're not fully successful with everything. And as you correctly pointed out, we see it also in ways in which they try to shield decision-making from the will of the population, from Portugal trickle to Poland. So this includes, of course, all of them. And this, I think, is the core problem. It's a bureaucratic project that was designed in a sense to protect democracy from the will of the people, which is a little bit of a contradiction in itself.
Yes, very much so. But von der Leyen has been plagued by scandal, but she's slippery. Why do you think that that is the case? And is there any way any European citizen could tell their leaders, hey, we'd like a real investigation of this lady and how she, used our money to buy a bunch of COVID vaccines?
Oh, that would be wonderful. But you have exactly this kind of situation, in particular with the COVID vaccines. Right? All the parties, all the politicians, with few exceptions, have put all their eggs in one basket. So they're all responsible with this for von der Leyen. She's kind of just the tip of the iceberg. So if you would start that investigation, it might start with her, but it would definitely not end with her. I mean, we know it in Austria, we know in Germany in certain areas, right, certain politicians in the health ministry. So there were lots of going-ons that, rumors, let's put it this way, but nobody's investigating, so we never will fully know what exactly happened. But that many decisions have been made that were not entirely sound, and even more importantly, that in many ways the decisions as they were sold to the public were either lies or a tremendous amount of incompetence or a mixture of both. This is something they want to avoid. This is the thing. If everybody is guilty of wrongdoing, nobody wants an investigation. And I think this is precisely where we find ourselves. But the frustrating part is that any kind of means of course correction is increasingly taken away or blocked for the people. As you correctly pointed out, we have these European elections in June. Whom can you vote for? Like, whom can you vote for and hope that they actually will have a say that in the future European Parliament will actually have a say in deciding who could be the president of the European Commission instead of Ursula von der Leyen? It's kind of, you go to the voting booth, you cast your vote, but it's still the same people and the same individuals that run the show. And that's very frustrating for everybody involved.
So we have no Claire Daly or Christine Anderson, these European parliamentarian members who do stand up to Ursula von der Leyen, sometimes to her face, but why don't they have the opportunity to run against her?
Because they are kind of lonely voices in the desert, if you want. And the reason for this is because the problem we have is, and I think that's very similar to what you see also with the Republican Party in the United States. You have the quote-unquote so-called conservatives in Europe. On the European level, it would be the European People's Party, that are, they are conservative or right-wing during election times, but once election times are over, they more or less shift towards left of center. You see this now. So all of a sudden, they discover that the Green New Deal and the Green Agenda might not be such a good idea. I'm pretty sure that immediately after the election in June, they will not remember that they were criticizing this just 2 weeks earlier. And this is the problem. They would not be willing to give any one of these politicians, like Christine Anderson or a candidate of their choosing, a proper chance. And that is, again, the problem, that the powers that are so entrenched in the institutions, they're so entrenched in the system, that it's very, very hard to get them out. And of course, a little bit of the responsibility also goes to the people, because sometimes I feel they're afraid of their own courage. So everybody's dissatisfied with the current system, but then almost too often, when it comes to voting, they vote for the same candidates, right? We see this in France. So you say you don't like Macron, but yet again, they vote for Macron. You see it in the United Kingdom, right? They complain about the Tories, then they vote for Labour, even though there would be other alternatives as well. You see it pretty much everywhere. I mean, Donald Trump, I think, remains the big exception there, where the people really said, let's try something entirely new. And even there, if we are completely honest, the reason was that so many people stayed at home, so that the small number that actually went to vote in 2016 then ultimately voted for Donald Trump. So this is kind of a little bit of blame is also with the electorate, I have to admit, because if you want change, you have to vote for it in large numbers.
Right. Well, let's turn our attention to NATO, because if Mark Rutte is in fact tapped to be the new Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, well, he resigned in the Netherlands. His problems there had to do with immigration and climate policy. What does he know about defense?
Well, I would argue that just like being the president of the European Commission, being the head of NATO is one of these positions that in many ways are more formal than they are actual, have a significant impact. And the reason why I'm saying this, within NATO, for better or worse, it depends where one stands politically, it is still the United States that call the shots. I think the most, or let me put it differently, Mark Rutte is such a middle-of-the-road politician that he would not ruffle many feathers. If NATO would really be courageous, they probably would consider somebody from Eastern Europe, for example, you know, somebody from Poland. That would be quite a step. Or any other kind of, let's say, a figure with a higher profile. But the issue, of course, with NATO is it's the same problem. NATO is, as we said before, if the EU is a 1970s problem to a 1940s problem, right, then NATO is kind of the same thing. It's a 2000 problem to a 1980s, or a 2000 solution to a 1980s problem. The alliance just sticks around because you have these agencies, you have high-paying jobs. Just with the European Union, right, governments and states, they need positions for older politicians. I know this sounds very cynical, but it's the truth. But ultimately, the purpose of the alliance is not really clear. And I think we see this also in the conflict with Ukraine. So I would argue this should be a moment for deep, deep self-reflection and introspection of where the alliance is supposed to go, especially given the fact that the United States will turn, for good reason, their back on Europe in the future. Their focus is increasingly in the Asia-Pacific region, and the Europeans simply demanding that the United States continue to provide protection and basically all the military components that are necessary for it indefinitely is not going to happen. Donald Trump is just saying what many people are thinking.
Right. So it's interesting because Mark Rutte this week at the security conference in Munich said that we need to stop whining about Trump because most European leaders are bracing for another Trump administration. And they're worried that their war games will be up if Donald Trump is elected. Mark Rutte says, oh, you know, we just need to stop whining about that and get on with it. So that seems to be the temperature right now. It's like they're playing war games for fun with lives, and they know that that is going to be up if a Biden administration ends, right?
Yeah, and the Europeans cannot fill that gap because you cannot have a large military and a large welfare state. And it's impossible for most, with the exception, again, of a few Eastern European countries, it's impossible for European states to cut back on welfare in the name of military defense. I mean, the fact is, if you take a look at every poll that has been taken in Europe, the people are neither willing nor ready to defend their country by military means. So NATO is, again, it's interesting as an option to free ride. This is how most Europeans use it. And this is why they're afraid that the United States will change course. And even the United States no longer have the capacity to provide protection. Europe is, to put it very simply, Europe is not as important as it was a couple of decades ago. Now, we did this to ourselves with deindustrialization, with playing a smaller and smaller and smaller role in the global economy, right? And Asia becoming more and more important. The attention of the US is shifting to Asia. Europe did this to itself, and now we have to live with the consequences.
Right. Well, these are fascinating. I hadn't considered that the shift of the United States to Asia would then lead to some sort of collapse and, I guess, a reduction in relevancy of NATO. I personally would love to see that because I was watching the Munich Security Conference this week with Jens Stoltenberg and the Prime Minister of Estonia and a U.S. senator, and I was so angry that they were just sort of playing poker with who's going to put down more money for Ukraine as a game based on lies. Just they're all demons. So I appreciate your we can agree on that at least, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is just as a quick note. I mean, and this is just the next thing you see. I mean, the Europeans have entirely, which is absurd because you could argue historically they invented it, they have completely lost the ability to think long-term strategically. I mean, whatever you hear, whatever one thinks morally or emotionally or even for good reasons, what the fair or just outcome should be in the war in Ukraine, you have to deal with the facts on the ground. And the idea, just recently read another article that said, so every risk must be accepted in the name of Ukraine. Again, I get the sentiment from a moral perspective. But to explain to Western Europeans, Germans in particular, that you have to sacrifice your economy for the sake of Crimea remaining Ukrainian, you will not have many takers for that. I mean, this is just the reality. And the country needs reconstruction. Can Europe afford this? So even if the war would end tomorrow, does Europe still have the economic means to reconstruct the country? So the long game on this is something that doesn't look too good for Ukraine. It doesn't look too good for Europe. And saying this, to be clear, does not make you a Putin bootlicker. That's analysis. Like, we only have advocates in politics, but nobody who does analytics. And I think that's the most important thing. The current borders, as they are between Russia and Ukraine, will remain one way or another. Like, there will be no Russian retreatment. There will be no great Ukrainian offensive that puts their army in front of Moscow. None of this is going to happen. And by the way, everybody who said this is going to happen over the last 2 years, they have been proven wrong. Now, once again, I'm not saying this because I'm cheering it on. But at some point, diplomacy is meant to look at the facts on the ground and say, how can we get the best outcome or kind of the best exit ramp from this situation? And I think we delude ourselves at the moment still. And this is, I think, very worrisome because, as you correctly point out, platitudes are easy, but actual policy is significantly more difficult.
Right. So we'll be stuck with these new leaders or promoted leaders, Ursula von der Leyen and Mark Rutte, and they will die on these swords. They will not retract and come back and say, we were wrong. Let's rebuild up our economy. That's my prediction anyway.
Well, to put it brutally, it's to pick up what you just said, it's not them who are going to die on the swords, right? That, as so often, it's going to be somebody else.
Right. Yeah. They'll drag us all down with them. So. Yeah. That's what it feels like to me. Thank you so much for your analysis. It's always
a
pleasure.
So
you can
me.
Follow Ralph on X. And do you have anything else you want to tell us about to follow?
No. Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thanks, Ralph. He's always great. Thank you, Ralph. Yeah. Appreciate that. All right. We've got more news to get to here on your Tuesday, if you can believe it. I mean, covering Julian Assange, covering the EU collapsing. We're also looking at the civilian attacks because, you know, you have the fall of the town of Avdiivka in Ukraine and Russian forces now closing in, taking over that city. Ukrainian forces leaving. But that's not without launching civilian attacks on a library this afternoon, killing civilians using American-made weapons. That's U.S. tax dollars at work, HIMAR weapons being used to attack civilians and kill civilians. Does a library serve a military target at all? Any military purpose at all? No, the answer is no. We're going to give you a report from the latest in Ukraine. But first,
we want to tell you about our friends over at Provia, because if you are one of the millions of American men and women of any age dealing with premature hair loss, maybe you're scared about inheriting that thinning look because it just runs in the family. Well, you should check out Provia, finally a real solution that delivers on its problems with promise without the harsh side effects or unwanted chemicals and no need for a prescription. Provia uses a safe natural ingredient called Procapil, to effectively target the three main causes of premature hair thinning and loss. So by supporting healthy scalp circulation, the delivery of nourishing nutrients and healthy hair follicles anchoring to your scalp, Provia guarantees more hair on your head than in the shower or on your comb. It's effective for men and women of any age, and it's safe on colored, treated, or styled hair. It's that easy. Right now, new customers save over 50% plus free shipping on Provia's introductory package if you go to proviahair.com/redacted. Every package includes a full 60-day supply of Provia serum for daily use, plus the Provia Super Concentrate for faster, more noticeable results. And every order includes your choice of a free gift right at checkout. Provia works or your money back 100% guarantee. So don't wait. Order now and save an extra 10% plus free shipping. Go to proviahair.com/redacted. That's proviahair.com/redacted.
So war correspondent Patrick Lancaster was all set to head to Avdiivka, where, of course, you have the fall of that city. The Ukrainian forces have basically succumbed to Russian advances there. They are leaving and surrendering, and that town is now under Russian control. Patrick was all set to get on the road to go bring us a report from there when suddenly a massive attack, a barrage of American NATO weapons launched into civilian areas in Donetsk. And Patrick just filed this short report for us in the aftermath of civilian casualties. Take a look.
Hello, Redacted. I'm Patrick Lancaster. Right now, we're in the center of Donetsk, in the intersection of Panfilyeva and Universitetskaya. And unfortunately, on the corner there, you see a family member checking on the body of their loved one who was just killed by a Ukrainian 155-millimeter shell that came raining down out of the sky. Killed this woman and reportedly a second person as well as injuring four other civilians. I say Ukrainian 155mm because that's who fired it. But the fact is that it's a Western-supplied, NATO-supplied 155mm artillery shell that Ukraine would not have if the West was not supplying this war. The Western tax dollars killed that woman there and injured and killed all the others as well here on the streets of Donetsk. That is what the Western tax dollars are doing here in Donetsk. The supply of weapons, lethal aid as they call it, from the West to Ukraine is killing the civilians here on the streets of Donetsk. Something needs to be done. The Western mainstream media is not going to be showing you this information. Only we are. Think for yourself. Yeah.
Ви понимаєте, откуда це стріляють?
Україна? Откуда стріляють? Я сама скоро візьму автомат і пойду вже захватувати. Це вже просто невозможно. 10 років от цих обстрілів. Ви постоянно, здесь мирне населення, здесь нет воєнних частей. Я здесь живу недалеко. Здесь нет ни одной воєнної части. Здесь нет ни одного воєнного. Здесь мирные жители. Міністерство образования, которое обеспечивает обучение детей Донецкой Народной Республики. И их обстреляли. За что? Которые стоят в тылу, держат тыл, и их еще обстреливают. А мирные люди, которые шли просто в магазин, за что их?
Вот такие были осколки. То есть это осколок от 155-го снаряда.
Okay, so I was just back to my apartment, and as soon as I got in the door, I was back from filming the woman, the civilians injured, killed. In the center. Now, as soon as I got in the door, two huge explosions happened. Looked out my window, saw black smoke.
Just moments ago, there was an attack by Ukrainian forces using what appears to be a United States-supplied HIMARS rocket. Just in the very center, you can see the crater here. Investigators are here on the scene. We're going to bring you as much information as possible.
Летела со стороны, вроде как с Красногоровки.
Ага, чей снаряд это?
Ну, чей? Украинский.
Ага, как?
Но на Украину не похоже. Это, походу, это натовский снаряд.
Здравствуйте. Где снаряд? Пожалуйста. Это библиотека, да?
Что?
Это библиотека.
Библиотека, да.
Ага, войны нету, да?
Войны нету, были люди посторонние, в том числе читатели были.
Ага.
Все пошли, да. Вода течет. На первом этаже только вода течет.
Есть народные дружины, да? Хотим приехать, там фронт открыть.
Надо закрыть. Давайте.
All right, just to give you a little bit of an understanding of what the situation here is and how big this rocket is itself. This is one of the two craters of these United States-supplied HIMARS hitting this library in the very center of Donetsk.
All right, thanks, Patrick. So,
That's shocking.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You're targeting libraries. People are in there reading books, and those are the people that you're targeting right now. And the people there know, of course, where these shells are coming from. I was speaking to Patrick, and then just as he was about to file this report, he said, I got to go. There's been another attack, and this one at the library, and so rushed out to bring us that report. So no other journalists you're going to see bringing that report. So thank you to Patrick for that update in Donetsk, where the civilian attacks continue. Despite Zelensky over the weekend saying we don't have the shells, we don't have the weapons, we don't have the material. Congress, United States Congress, who goes on a vacation for 2 weeks and doesn't send us these weapons? We need you to send us these weapons. And so the weapons you do have, you're using to target civilians?
Yes, have been all
piece
along.
Of garbage.
We've been covering that for now 2 years.
You little green-shirted troll. This is where these are the people you want to attack. Right now, people sitting in libraries. Makes me.
Well, these are the people that they're fighting so hard, and we're sending billions so that they can recapture that area.
Right.
Right.
That is not how you win hearts and minds.
Right. We win hearts and minds about blowing up libraries and killing civilians.
Now, the woman who is standing there is in the contested territory, which Ukraine thinks is Ukraine. So when she says When he asks her, where are these bombs coming from? She says, Ukraine. She knows now. She's no longer in Ukraine. That area is Russia.
Right.
According to her vote, right? And she knows, and she said it's been coming from there for 10 years, just like it has been all along. So a mystery.
Now, you're a Putin propagandist if you tell that, right? You're a mouthpiece of Putin if you tell the truth, I guess.
So this is what the West wants, that lady to be in Ukraine, even though Ukraine bombs her.
Yeah, unbelievable. Just another war going on right in front of our faces right now while we continue to fund them. We've got more news to get to here. The next story, I'm warning you, is shocking. Some of you may know about this story. I'm going to argue that probably a huge chunk of you do not know about this story. Let me just say, it's unbelievable, and we all need to be paying attention to this. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at Tax Network. What we want you to do, if you owe any back taxes, if you know, pandemic relief is over right now, along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 right now by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. They want their money so they can send it to Ukraine. Don't waive your rights and speak with them on your own. They are not your friends. Tax Network USA is a trusted tax relief firm. They've saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best deal possible. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help you. Whether it's because it's business or personal taxes, it doesn't matter. Even if you have the means to pay or you are on a fixed income, they can help you finally resolve your tax burdens once and for all. That website right there on your screen, go there and visit them, tnusa.com/redacted. Or call their 800 number, 1-800-254-6000, to get a free consultation. Just give them a call and just get a free consultation. They can totally help you. Or go to tnusa.com/redacted.
Is fluoride bad for us? That's what's being litigated in California right now in a major lawsuit that is not getting a lot of attention. Surprisingly, Derek Brose has been following this acutely. He's asked to come on Redacted and tell us about it. And we said, yes, absolutely. We want to know everything about that. Closing arguments are happening in the case today in San Francisco. So it's a good day to talk about it. Derek, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for giving a little bit of a signal boost to this story.
Right. Okay. So take us through it. Why is this such a landmark case and why do we not know about it? Can you give us a little bit of the history and the history of it not only happening, but being silenced?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a law that was passed in the United States called the Toxic Substance Control Act, which allows regular people, American citizens, to petition the EPA if they believe that a chemical or a compound has been proven to be toxic. And in this case, the Fluoride Action Network, Moms Against Fluoridation, and a few different plaintiffs, mothers whose children have been affected by water fluoridation, they filed a petition under TSCA to the EPA in 2016, essentially arguing that the data proves that fluoride is a neurotoxin and that it affects the IQ of children, especially during pregnancy and then postnatal. And the EPA rejected the petition, and this led to a lawsuit. So this has been going on since 2016, 2017, and it's essentially just kind of been the courtroom proceedings. But the first phase of the trial actually began in summer 2020. Of course, it was COVID lockdown, so it took place via Zoom. And I was reporting on it for The Last American Vagabond, doing live tweeting while watching Zoom and just writing articles. And in that first phase of the trial, there were some pretty big revelations that I can share about today. But essentially what happened in 2020, Judge Edward Chin, the federal judge who's overseeing this case, he decided that since the U.S. government's National Toxicology Program, the NTP, was at that time currently studying fluoride, they were doing what's called a monograph. They were doing this massive review of all the data on fluoride, and they were focusing on just the low risk of bias, high quality studies, and trying to, you know, decide, is this really a toxin or is it not? And so the judge at that time said, you know what, this NTP report's going on right now. Let's just put everything on hold for a moment. Let's wait for this report to come out. And well, fast forward, here we are 4 years later, and the report still hasn't been officially released. But in that time, because of the lawsuit, one of the beautiful things of this lawsuit, and one of the other things that makes it historic, is the Fluoride Action Network and their lead attorney, Michael Conant, who's a brilliant attorney, they were able to do discovery and to file open records requests and to get all kinds of data from the government. And in that process, they obtained emails from the CDC's Oral Health Division, as well as emails that mention U.S. Assistant Secretary of Health Rachel/Richard Levine, intervened to prevent the NTP study from coming out. These emails, which we've released in the last year or so, show that the NTP scientists, U.S. government scientists, wanted to release the report in May 2022, but these elements of the U.S. government prevented it from coming out. And the only reason we know that is because of these emails that came out in the lawsuit. And
Wait. That's shocking. Rachel Levine, we know, is no stranger to giving substances with wild abandon to every human body. And so what was the justification for holding back this report?
So they, you know, the U.S. government has publicly said they don't think it's ready for release, that it's not complete, the evidence is not clear, it's inconclusive, these sort of things. But the interesting thing, because of these emails, again, we actually have the emails of the scientists themselves. So while the scientists at the National Toxicology Program were saying our study's ready for release May 2022, they had already set the date for publication, they were going to publish it on their servers. And then while they're having that conversation, over at the CDC and HHS, they're saying this report's not going to happen. And email specifically mentions Rachel Levine will not let this report come out.
That's not how a research report works. You don't run it through the politicians to see if they like it. If the scientists think it's done, then we should be able to see it. That in and of itself is shocking. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's important to kind of break that down. And I think that the most important point here to highlight is, okay, so what was the scientist's conclusion, right? What did they conclude? What did they conclude? We do know because, again, because of this study, and now that we've resumed the second phase, Judge Chin did allow the NTP report in its draft form, since it's never been officially released. He did allow it into evidence. And that report says fluoride exposure is associated with lower IQ in children. It couldn't be more clear as day as that. And that is what this whole case is revolving around. Can the Fluoride Action Network prove to Judge Edward Chin, as they've been trying for the last 2 weeks in San Francisco, to show him that the data proves that we have more than enough evidence, as the NTP, the government's own scientists, have said, fluoride has an association with lower IQ in children, specifically when pregnant mothers are consuming it. And then, of course, postnatal, it has a very detrimental impact on our neurocognitive development. And so I actually, as you mentioned, have been in San Francisco the last 2 weeks, and I had the opportunity to interview three of the expert witnesses, three of the scientists that were presenting for the Fluoride Action Network. And if I could just briefly, I'd like to quote directly from them, because I'm not a scientist, I'm just a journalist myself. But I asked Dr. Howard Hu, for example, and he said, quote, "Yes, I would say that in my view, the evidence is quite persuasive that there is a negative impact of fluoride exposure on the neurodevelopment of children, particularly the research that's been coming out in prenatal exposure." And then I asked Dr. Bruce Lamphere the same question, and he said, quote, "Well, what we found, whether we looked at urinary fluoride levels from the mom as a measure or water fluoride, was that in every case, we saw IQ deficits in the children." So this is why you're not hearing about this story, because this poison is in the water and your taxpayer dollars are paying for it. And there's elements of the U.S. government trying to prevent this study from coming out. You know, of course, we have other studies and other data, but they know that this study coming from the U.S. government's own branch of scientists would be pretty powerful and pretty impactful. So instead, they've done everything they can to prevent it from being released to the public.
Now, the plaintiffs in this case that are suing the EPA, what do they want? Do they want it removed, or do they want damages, or all of those things?
They're just, at this point, this is just specifically a suit to see. So if you do win in the petition process under TSCA, the EPA has several different actions that they can take. And one of those, yes, would be banning it or regulating it. As it is now, I think that the case here is trying to prove that we can prove that fluoride is causing harm. We might not know the exact level, but if we're going to err on the side of the precautionary principle, or what the EPA calls the uncertainty factor, which is when you consider the most vulnerable populations, then it should be banned. You know, even if you, this is what the process they've done with lead, what they've done with mercury. And in fact, I think it's probably appropriate to say that fluoride is the new lead. Fluoride is the new mercury, because two of the expert witnesses that spoke at this trial for the plaintiffs, Dr. Bruce Lamphere and Dr. Philippe Granging, are the leading experts who helped develop the EPA's own regulatory protocols for lead and for mercury. And in this case, they're speaking up and saying this is even more harmful. This is causing damage internally. I could speak more about, you know, when a mother, like they showed data showing that as the mother progresses through her pregnancy, by the third trimester, as she's drinking more water and consuming more to feed her baby, if she's drinking fluoridated water, she's increasing the amount of fluoride in her body. It stores in her bones. And then as her baby starts to form its skeletal structure, it's going to pull all that fluoride right out of mom's bones into its body, pass through the blood-brain barrier, into the placenta. And it's showing that there is an impact on cognitive development.
I believe whole house filtration systems, though, do they filter out fluoride? A lot of them do, right?
So the only thing that we know that does filter out fluoride, and it's not even, I would say, 100%, depending on the quality of the filter, is reverse osmosis.
Right.
So reverse osmosis will remove everything. Of course, it removes like everything. So if you're doing that, it's advisable to kind of remineralize your water with some trace minerals or something. But yeah, you could, if you have the money and you have the ability, you can buy shower filters, you can buy house filters, you can go buy the 5-gallon jugs and fill up at the local water filtration system. But as is typical with these kind of situations, the people who are, let's say, lower socioeconomic status, don't have extra cash to spend, they're going to be the ones who are most impacted by this, because you are showering it, you're cooking in it, you're drinking it. If you're eating processed foods, it more than likely has fluoridated water. When you go out to eat at a restaurant, more than likely has fluoridated water being given to you. And fluoride is also in pesticides. So it's not just, this case is focused on water fluoridation, but there is actually so many different exposures that, at least in the United States, that we're all facing.
Can you remind us all why the United States has fluoride in the water to begin with?
Sure. So in the 1940s, you know, there's actually a really great book I'll recommend for those who want to do a deep dive more than we have time today. It's called The Fluoride Deception by journalist Christopher Bryson. But he goes through the history and actually, you know, there's some connections to the Manhattan Project and the U.S. nuclear program. Not only were they studying uranium, but they were also studying fluoride. And they understood the impact way back then. There were some incidents where fluoride, because what we're calling fluoride, there is naturally occurring fluoride, calcium fluoride, sodium fluoride, and it's important to know that all of the types of fluoride have been associated with harm. So just because it's quote unquote naturally occurring doesn't mean it doesn't cause harm. But most of what we're talking about, what's added to the U.S. water supply, is hydrofluorosilicic acid, which is a byproduct of aluminum phosphate mining. And in the past, these companies, they would have had to pay to dispose of this toxin. Instead, now they're getting paid by cities around the United States to add it to the water. And so in the 40s and the 50s, there was quite a bit of propaganda. There were, the American Dental Association working with Edward Bernays, working with Alcoa, which is the aluminum, representing the aluminum industry. They came together and started getting studies produced that claimed that because fluoride hardens the bones, which it does, that it's good for the teeth. And thus, you know, if we're going to help all these poor kids in the rural areas who don't have proper dental care, we need to start fluoridating the water. And much like vaccines, the CDC, if you go on their website, they currently promote water fluoridation as one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. So there are some major influences in people that would like for this story to stay suppressed and would like for water fluoridation to continue happening, not only because then the companies who produce this toxic waste would have to figure out how they're going to dispose of it without getting paid to, you know, put it in the water, but also the potential here, you asked about money earlier, if the judge does find in the case of the plaintiffs, you would imagine that the American Dental Association, the CDC, the FDA, and all the various branches of government who've been promoting this for generations now, going on 80 years, would potentially be opened up to class action lawsuits by parents and family members who might say, did my child lose IQ points? Is my thyroid messed up because of fluoride? Are my hips, you know, hurting because of, do I have arthritis because of fluoride? These are all symptoms of overfluoridation and fluoride exposure.
Crap. Okay. This is really upsetting me. So, okay, what is at stake here for the closing arguments today? What specifically is the judge going to rule about in the next few days? And then what happens next?
Sure. So what we're dealing with right now is the closing arguments are taking place from the EPA, from the government, and the closing arguments from the Fluoride Action Network. The judge also has.
I'm sorry, but can
questions.
I interrupt you with a question? Is the EPA really trying to argue that it's fine?
Well, this is another reason why it's historic. They have acknowledged that it is causing harm. I will say that this is the first time probably ever that the EPA in a court, their attorneys have said, okay, judge, we know it's causing harm, but what they're essentially trying to do is say, the CDC recommends water fluoridation at 0.7 milligrams per liter. and there's no evidence that, or the evidence is fuzzy, it's cloudy once we get closer to that. Yeah, we know it causes harm, but that's only at these higher levels. And so they're admitting, yes, there's harm, but it's way beyond the legally allowable limits. So judge, it's too uncertain. You shouldn't rule this way. Where Fluoride Action Network and Michael Connett, they've proven, and the data shows, that even at the levels of the current North American drinking water levels, there is harm. I mean, there was a brand new study that just came out from the Canadian Health Agency, actually, because Canada and the UK are actually right now considering starting to fluoridate their countries. So that's why this is also important. But as far as what's taking place today, they're both going to make closing arguments. And then the judge, he will have some questions, because this is a historic case in the sense that this is the first time a federal judge is being asked to rule on science. And I imagine most scientists don't want a judge kind of second guessing their work. And obviously the judge isn't a scientist, but he's been doing his best to keep up. You know, they're talking benchmark and point of departure and margin of exposure and all these jargony terms, and the judge is stopping them every now and saying, hold on, okay, I'm getting confused. Can you explain that to me? He seems to be genuinely trying to understand the whole case. He hasn't just been on the government side, and he hasn't really been on the Fluoride Action Network side. He seems like he really wants to get to the bottom of this. So after today concludes, he'll take some time to review all the evidence, all the witness testimony, and hopefully within a couple of weeks, we will have an answer and a ruling here. And hopefully it goes the side of the Fluoride Action Network. So one of the other really important components, I think, to mention is what Dr. Philippe Grønning told me. Again, he's a Danish scientist. He's one of the leading experts in mercury and has done some amazing work. And in the 2020 phase of the lawsuit, he said something along the lines of he had been he'd been pushed out of Harvard. And he also mentioned that the World Health Organization had been taken over by the fluoride lobby. And I got really curious about that. And so I actually got to interview him last week and had him sit down and explain a little further. What did you mean by that? And again, I'd like to just quote directly from him if I could. He relayed this story to me of how he started to study water fluoridation and its relation to neurotoxicity at Harvard. And he had another professor come up to him. And he said this, quote, a professor from Harvard came to my office and asked me to sign a statement that my work on fluoride had nothing to do with fluoridation. He actually wrote this draft, and since I didn't sign immediately, he instead went to my dean and had the dean sign a statement that that he supported water fluoridation in accordance with the policy of the CDC. And he basically said they took his name off this report. They put out a report saying fluoride was great. And he told me, quote, because I couldn't agree on what I consider my academic freedom, I left Harvard. And then when I asked him about what happened at the World Health Organization, he said that he was hired to help the World Health Organization develop environmental health criteria. And as he began gathering his data and putting his report together, he said, quote, they inserted changes in my draft indicating that fluoride could perhaps be toxic, but only at immense concentrations. I protested and said that in accordance with the scientific documentation, it would be wrong to insert the word immense. And so the WHO published a document without my name, because I took my name off, and they inserted some other colleague's name as the author of the draft, which is, of course, erroneous. But that was what the WHO felt was necessary in order to protect the interests of water fluoridation.
Okay. So again, we have proof that when you mix science with politics, you get politics. And that seems to be what's happening. So will you come back and give us updates on this case then as you continue to follow it?
Absolutely. I would love to come back and share. And I hope everybody hearing this can visit my website, theconsciousresistance.com. You can see all those interviews I just mentioned. You can find my reporting, all the articles I've written for the last 4 years at thelastamericanvagabond.com. We have a fluoride trial section. And I will be following and keeping up on these updates and happy to share them with your audience.
Okay. Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you for the first time, and I'm sure it won't be the last time.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
That does it for us here at Redacted today on this Tuesday. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. Share these videos, like, and subscribe if you're not already. We really appreciate you. Hey, you can also subscribe to the Redacted newsletter. Easy to do, totally free, nothing behind a paywall. Go to redacted.inc, put in your email address. And like I said, it's free. It has a lot of the links to the sources that we talk about in this show. We are very pro educate yourself. Form your own opinion. This is a free speech platform. We want you to be educated and happy, productive, healthy, all those things. We want those things for you and for all of us. So thank you again for joining us today on Redacted. We will see you here tomorrow. We'll be back at 4 p.m. Eastern live. We appreciate you. See you tomorrow.